Welcome, baseball amigos, to the latest episode of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available exclusively via the Nats GM Radio Network. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the Baron of All Baseball Podcasts. Before we begin this week, I would like to mention that the Nats GM Show is currently seeking a sponsor or sponsors for the show. So if you or anyone you know is interested in sponsoring this podcast, please go to NatsGM.com for further details.
This is Mike Farron from SiriusXM's MLB Network Radio, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
We are proud to welcome to the show the head baseball coach at Centenary University and also the assistant athletic director. I've got Scott Kushner with me. Scott, welcome to the Nats GM Show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I've interviewed you. I've had the pleasure of talking to you a couple times over at the Banished to the Pen podcast, but I was really eager and excited to have you on this show and dive a little bit deeper into a Division III head coach, kind of what everything that entails, and kind of picking your brain a little bit about baseball.
Happy to do it.
All right. Well, first place I want to start is just kind of talk a little bit about your career path and maybe give you the floor to talk a little bit about Centenary University for those that maybe aren't as aware, and talk a little bit about how you arrived at that university.
Sure. So I started, I guess, playing in college Division III. So I went to Swarthmore College, which is a small liberal arts school just outside of Philadelphia, and I played baseball there for 4 years. And Swarthmore's not necessarily, at the time, certainly wasn't known for its baseball or producing professional sports coaches or anything like that. but baseball was the thing that just, it was my passion when I was there, it was a thing that I excelled at the most, and it was a thing that I looked forward to the most in a given school year, which is probably not how it should have been, but it is where what I really truly enjoyed. And so when I was finished and graduated, I was trying to think what to do next, and I always enjoyed sports and things like that. So there was a graduate, and this was when sports management was really just kind of starting to be mainstream as an academic discipline. And there was a graduate program at UMass Amherst, and with the urging of some of my friends and family, I applied to that program, and I was very fortunate to get in. I think there were only 19 people in my class, and I was the only one that was directly out of undergrad. Most of the people had been out in the workforce for several years. There were a few people that were a little younger, but there were people that were in their 30s, and there were here I was, and I was young for a college senior. I think I was still 21 when I got into the program, and it was a very international group. I mean, that we had people from the Netherlands, Japan, Korea, China, and just some kid that. I think I actually skipped my last day of classes to go to the interview for the program. So that's how I got in. I got into sports management, and that was it's a very unique program there, where basically it was just a year of intense classwork up in Amherst, and made some great friends up there, some fantastic people, and then when I was done, I ended up doing my internship back at Swarthmore as an assistant coach. And I just realized as I was going through the graduate school process, and there were opportunities to work in, ticket sales and marketing and maybe minor league baseball or for a professional, basketball organization or something like that. And I wanted to be closer to the game, closer to the field, and baseball was what I, had played most throughout my life. So just wanting to be, connected to that, I thought I'll stay with coaching and I'll work in college athletics, and I thought it would be a very enjoyable pursuit. And going back to where I had gone to school and played, obviously I had a personal connection there. And I was there for 3.5 years before I got my first head coaching job offer, and that was at the Merchant Marine Academy on Long Island. So that was it was kind of a unique set of circumstances where the job had been posted in the summer, which is typically when these jobs come out, and I didn't apply. and I didn't want to move to Long Island. Just didn't have any interest in working at a federal service academy. It just seemed very, very off from what I was doing. And at the time, the head coaching position at Swarthmore had opened up. The guy that I was working for was no longer the coach. So I thought, hey, here, I'm gonna take over at my alma mater. This will be great. And then throughout the fall, I was the interim head coach, and they were going through the interview process, and I didn't end up getting the Swarthmore job. And I'm not gonna lie, I was young and I was stupid and I was bitter about it. But I can say in hindsight that they've made the smart choice of hiring somebody with years of experience and success, as opposed to, you know, some young green kid who, you know, just wanted to be there because it was his alma mater. And so now, somehow the Merchant Marine job was opened up again. The guy that they had hired in the summer lasted only a month and left, basically. And so this time I said, you know what, I'm going to apply to the job this time. And I got hired, and it was a little bit of a surprise. It was definitely a change of pace. It's very to go from Swarthmore, which is just a ultra liberal, idyllic, beautiful setting. A very kind of I would say a hyper. I'm trying to think of the word, like just everything you would expect in a liberal arts institution, but just cranked up several other notches. it is the poster child for that kind of stuff. And then to go from there to a federal service academy where everybody is in uniform. I had to go through a military checkpoint to even get to work. All the students live in barracks. You know, the freshmen or the plebes, you know, the basically the first year guys are going, turning on right corners, just to walk down the hallway. I mean, everything was so different. And such a unique setting, and it's on Long Island, which in itself is a whole other world compared to the suburbs of Philadelphia.
Yeah, I went to Gettysburg College, so I can relate a little bit Swarthmore environment.
Oh yeah, so I'm in the same conference as Swarthmore. Yeah. Sure. And Gettysburg is beautiful, but it's such a different setting, and so I was there for two seasons, and really didn't enjoy it. And at the time, I was living with my now wife. And she moved out there with me, and neither of us was really enjoying living out on Long Island. I certainly wasn't enjoying. I was, in addition to doing baseball, I was I was a director of physical fitness, which for a federal service academy, they all have a fitness requirement. So there's every single student there has to pass a physical fitness test, and it's a pretty grueling test by college fitness test standards. So I would have to run these, big tests you're testing 1,000 students at a time. And then anybody who failed the test would have to come in for training at 5 in the morning. Well, guess who gets to run those trainings? This guy. So that means I'm waking up at, 4:15 to get to work, so I can run a training by 5. And then once that's done, then I get to teach a phys ed class, and then I get to coach baseball. It was an exhausting time.
For somebody not in that lifestyle, that sounds really difficult.
Yeah, it was. And there's a huge amount of respect I had for the students that went there. I did find it a little tough to recruit. The Merchant Marine Academy is a special place because it's one of those things where your time there is not necessarily going to be the most enjoyable. It's not going to be your typical college experience per se, but it's for individuals who aren't necessarily looking for that. They're looking to make an investment in, 4 years from then, when they are going to basically be guaranteed a job. They're going to travel and see the world. There's a lot of pluses to it, but it only really works for a very specific individual. And finding those individuals is not an easy task. And living amongst those individuals is not an easy task. So it was something that I wanted to break from. And as luck would have it, Centenary, which had been in our conference when I first got there, that job opened up, and it was in New Jersey, which I never thought I'd ever live in New Jersey. I grew up in California, and all you know about New Jersey when you live on the West Coast is it's like toxic waste dump, basically. And here we are, and my wife and I have now been in New Jersey for this is our ninth year. My wife ended up getting a job at Centenary as well. And so we both live in town. We both work at the university. And, you know, we really like it. It's, you know, it's a beautiful place. And, you know, I've just kind of grown ever since.
So I think this is a good place for me to try to transition a little bit and ask you a little bit about what it's like coaching at the D3 level, how you,
sure.
you know, how you recruit. If I understand correctly, D3 schools can't give athletic scholarships. So how
right.
do you, you know, you said obviously, and I can imagine recruiting at the Merchant Marines is difficult, but how is it at Centenary? What are your, how are you selling your school? How do you go about finding players and all that stuff?
Sure. Well, you know, it's funny is I think at any place you go to, there are challenges. You know, when I was at Swarthmore, there were challenges, even though, you know, it's a top academic school, so a lot of people want to go there, but it was very hard to find people who qualified academically. Then you go to Merchant Marine Academy, not a whole lot of people want to go there, but there's a clear hook there in the sense that you're basically guaranteed a job, it's tuition-free, you know, your future is set up if you can survive the place for 4 years. So, there, you know, it has a unique hook. Centenary was a lot tougher for me because it doesn't have, you know, we're not an elite academic institution. You know, you don't need to get a perfect SAT score to get in here. You know, and we're a small school. Most people haven't heard about it. You know, there are people who live within 10 miles of the school who have never actually been to our campus. So it's kind of operating in an anonymity. It's difficult. It's difficult because there isn't that super strong and obvious hook there. So, you know, what I look for is, you know, when we go recruiting, we're looking for guys, first of all, who we think can make an impact with us baseball-wise, right? So you're looking for skill level. You're looking for, you know, kind of an athleticism, knowing full well that a guy who's totally polished, a guy who has all the tools you're looking for is probably not going to end up with you. You still ask. You know, it doesn't hurt to try, but those guys are typically – holding out for Division I scholarship offers or trying to go to a top 25 school, or a lot of times if they have not just top-notch athletic credentials, but their academics are in the elite nature, you know, they're looking to go to an Ivy League school or a school like Swarthmore or a, you know, or even a school like the Merchant Marine Academy, some place that kind of has the cachet of being an elite institution. And we're just not that here. So it's, you know, you kind of shift your focus. You find out what the academic, you know, what the SAT scores are, and the range of not just the students who would come here, but the students who would still flourish. You know, you look at what sort of areas, you know, we get at Swarthmore and at Merchant Marine. I was traveling and recruiting nationally. Here, I'm basically in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York, Connecticut, and that's about it. You know, that's our draw is just from our local region. So, you know, it's looking in the right area, looking for the right academic fit, looking for the right skill set. And then what you do really is you cast a very broad net and you say, all right, I've identified, you know, over the course of a summer between myself and assistant coaches, we may identify thousands of kids that we've seen. We whittle that down to kids that we think, you know, would really make an impact for us. We ask them, tell them about the school through email, through phone calls, you know, to see if we can set up visits and bring them to the campus. Just getting them here is a big challenge. But then they get to campus and we kind of can inform them with the campus tour. They meet with admissions. They meet with me. And then after that, it's just you just keep narrowing it down to the kids that are still interested and start the application process and kind of go through it there. But it's a long thing, and you know, it's difficult because even when you get a commitment at the Division III level, since I can't make a financial commitment to anybody, there's really nothing that binds anyone to the agreement. So if I have a player who says, "Coach, I'm coming to play for you at Centenary next year," I'm excited, but I'm just holding my breath until they actually arrive on campus the next year because nothing holds them to that, you know, handshake agreement. Even putting a deposit down with the school only puts them in for that deposit, which is refundable, by the way. So even if they put a $300 deposit down for housing, they could just not show up in August and, you know, not there goes your recruit. He's not there anymore. So it is a little nerve-wracking that first week in the fall.
And do you lose players often? I mean, you know, somebody all of a sudden gets a lot better over the summer. You find a diamond in the rough, and all of a sudden the team, you know, with a, and I'm using the air quotes, bigger profile kind of, you know, poaches them?
No, I think that, you know, I'm fortunate that that hasn't happened really to us so much. It's the possibility more, you know, it's the not knowing. But what ends up happening is I feel like there's kind of a trickle-down effect, right? So your very, very best high school players are being recruited by the top Division I's and maybe, you know, potentially being drafted by major league teams. Those guys you almost never even see. You don't, you know, the guys that are throwing 95, I don't worry about them so much. But then every tier of player below that is just trying to get to the highest level of baseball possible. And what ends up happening is when you play at a school like ours, which, I mean, we are kind of a middle of the pack Division III school without huge name recognition. Basically, anybody that actually would play for us is probably holding out to see if maybe a Division I is going to send them a scholarship, or maybe they can play at Division II, or, you know, maybe they'll just go to a 2-year school and then reassess their options there. So it's not that once a recruit commits to me, I've had, you know, nothing but you know, pretty solid success in maintaining them and keeping them. It's more a matter of them waiting and waiting and waiting so that they're not closing out any of their options, which I understand from their point, but I think sometimes they put themselves in a bad spot by waiting too long.
That makes sense. So what are some of the challenges that you have? I mean, obviously, geography is tough. I mean, New Jersey isn't the easiest for baseball in the spring, but what are some of the challenges you have practice schedule-wise and developing players? I mean, like you said, I it feels like you've got to look for somebody that can develop a little bit or has some potential to be a player, you know, maybe down the road or with a tweak or some improvement or what have you.
Sure, sure. So with just the logistics of actually – playing baseball in the Northeast, you know, we play games as early as February, and it's pretty cold in February, and sometimes it's covered in snow in February, so it does prove difficult. And even if you somehow miraculously are playing, then what kind of practice have you gotten in at that time? Most of our practices occur. We start practice usually the last week of January, beginning of February, and we are in a basketball gym, so. Our basketball gym has a batting cage that comes down from the ceiling. We have some indoor mounds we could put down, so our pitchers can throw bullpens to the catchers. Our hitters can hit in a batting cage. You know, we work on bunting. We'll take all the equipment away, and we'll throw down some throw bases in the gym and simulate a bunt defense or first and third situations. But ultimately, you're still in a basketball gym. You know, you're still, you know, getting ground balls rolled to you on the hardwood floor. Our outfielders are still seeing fly balls that go no higher than 20 feet in the air. So there are some serious limitations to what you can do. And, you know, and so we just, we try and be creative. We try and get them as close to game speed as possible, when we're practicing. And then we have our university has like a turf soccer and lacrosse field. And so if there's not snow out there and it's a day that's above 40 degrees, we'll go out there. We can practice there too. So at least there we can, you know, throw the ball a little further, hit balls in the air, you know, ground balls off of the turf, that kind of thing, and move around a little bit more than we can in the basketball gym. But weather, so very weather dependent and also very schedule dependent. When we start practice, you have men's basketball and women's basketball are still in their season. So they're using the basketball gym. We have wrestling here. Wrestling doesn't have to practice in the gym, but they hold their matches in the gym. So if they have a match, that basically wipes out the gym almost the entire day. We have softball. We have men's lacrosse. We have women's lacrosse, and we have baseball. So you have potentially 7 teams all trying to use the same facility, and you have classes going on. So it's not like I can just say, hey, we're going to have practice at 8 a.m. because I would have half my team in class. So it's really, you got 7 teams fighting over maybe 4 or 5 hours, where classes are lightened up in the afternoon. It's not an ideal situation. Now a lot of schools are in a similar situation. That's not necessarily unique to us, but it is one of the challenges of having, you know, a small school with limited resources and limited, practice space.
Well, and the final question I have for you on this topic is I just love to kind of give a coach an opportunity to sell Division III baseball. I think too often, you know, we hear about, and you've mentioned it, the D1 schools, the top 25 programs, sure, the ones that are in the College World Series. But, you know, there's a lot of really good baseball being played at the D3 level and a lot of really good baseball players playing there. And I just kind of want, if you could, to just sell the audience on, you know, D3 baseball.
Well, there's a lot to sell. So I think the first thing to know is that there are a lot more opportunities in Division III baseball than there are in any other divisions. There are nearly 400 Division III baseball schools spread out throughout the country, which I think dwarfs any of the other divisions by a long shot. That means the majority of college baseball players are playing Division III. And I think what that does, I think that kind of flies in the face of what is perceived, which is, you know, college baseball is Division I. You see it on ESPN. You see them, you know, playing the Super Regionals or the College World Series in Omaha. And that is such a, like, tiny sliver of what college baseball really is in its true form. You know, that's great to aspire to be there, but very few players ever reach that. And so I think for the majority of high school players out there, and, you know, a lot of the players who play in high school will never play college baseball. But those who really are interested and have the ability to play at the college level, most of those players are going to play Division III. They just don't know it yet. And a lot of times, whether it's through parents or teammates or former teammates or just, you know, what they see on TV, they sometimes get, you know, get their head in the clouds a little bit and think that everybody's going to get a scholarship. And go Division I. Another beauty of Division III, and this is not unique to baseball necessarily, is it really does stress the balance of student and athlete. And I know that it's easy to point to maybe Division I basketball or Division I football and the kind of schedules those guys keep. I think Division I baseball, you know, it's not as high profile a sport as those other two, but it's a grueling schedule at the Division I level to be flying, you know, around the country, to be playing. I think they play 50 some odd games in a season, sometimes many more with postseason. They play well into the summer. I mean, it is a full-time job, and my hat's off to the guys who are able to balance the academic workload with that. But I think usually at those higher levels, I think you really have to kind of make a sacrifice on many guys have to make a sacrifice on their academics in order to fully be invested in at the higher level, the Division I level of playing baseball. At Division III, and of course this can fluctuate from school to school, it really is, there's a slightly smaller schedule. We play a 40-game schedule. We have kind of stricter limitations on how often we can meet. And as a baseball coach, of course, I would love to be with my team more and practice more and that kind of stuff. But I look at it as I'm not here to just crank out a bunch of future major leaguers. That is not a realistic goal. A realistic goal is that I am giving a bunch of college baseball players the best experience possible for 4 years to develop skills, not just baseball skills, but life skills, and then to set them on their way after they graduate, so that they can be successful in whatever career they choose. I think that's a more realistic thing that college should be preparing people for. And I've had friends that have played Division I, some of them who have loved their experience and some of them who have not. And I think there are a lot of people who maybe even play Division I who have that ability, but still would wish they maybe had gone a different route so that they could play more, they could, you know, be better balanced, and they could be better prepared for their next step in life when it comes.
Yeah, well, you sold me, that's for sure. So another topic that I want to ask you about, and you kind of alluded to it in your answer, but you didn't particularly go there, is the growth of travel sports, particularly travel baseball, obviously, in sure. this conversation. I don't want to, you know, taint your answer or lead you in a certain direction, but it's just been one of the big banes of my, you know, existence is way too strong of a way to put it, but something that really bothers sure. me is, I mean, when I was growing up, and I'm not that old, I'm 36, I knew one kid that played a travel sport, one, right. and that was hockey, because hockey wasn't around in Maryland.
Kind of unique, yeah.
Right. Now, I would say that 70% of the kids that I come in contact with are playing some type of a travel sport, and that's 20 years. first of all, how have we gotten there and everything else is another topic. But I'd just love to get your thoughts on the entire industry, you know, from a coaching perspective. Does it help you? Does it hurt you? How has it gotten so big? And just, like I said, just give you the floor for that whole big topic.
Well, you know, I just to put it bluntly, I'm not a fan of the way that we have handled travel sports and the, you know, these particularly these super high profile, very expensive teams that seem almost like a prerequisite if you want to play beyond high school these days. And I know that that's not necessarily a popular stance amongst baseball coaches in particular. You know, many of my friends coach travel baseball. You know, the opportunity to, you know, it's big business, really. That's what it boils down to, is there's a whole lot of people that we've now flooded the market. We've flooded the market with people who are former professional players, former college players. You know, I talked in, you know, we were discussing Division III versus Division I, and at the Division III level, I feel like, you know, you often have a better balance. You know, if you've spent your whole life preparing to play professional baseball, and now you're not a professional baseball player, or you are and you're not making much money, you're not making the multimillion-dollar contract, what are you going to do with your life? Well, you're probably going to keep coaching baseball or be around the game. And so, hey, how do I make this profitable? Well, I'm a former minor leaguer. I'm going to get a team together, and I'm going to charge a premium amount for them to get to train with me. After all, I was a professional baseball player, and I'm going to get them to a high level. And it just becomes this, you know, cyclical thing of you know, people who are very good at baseball, very knowledgeable at baseball. I think some of the coaches that coach travel ball are very good. It can vary, but some of them are very good. But my question is, what is the point of it? And I think the point for most travel baseball is to make money coaching travel baseball. Even the places that have the best interest in the players themselves at heart, which is like to try and, you know, make them the best baseball players available, you know, possible, reach their potential, get them exposure with colleges. They do all those things. I don't deny that those things happen, but I think there's a kind of a false bill of goods in the sense that even when a player reaches his full potential, and even when a player gets exposure to colleges, most of the time it's not going to financially pay for itself. You know, parents are putting down tens of thousands of dollars, sometimes much more than that, over the lifetime of a young player's career before they even reach college, in the hopes of cashing in theory, by getting, you know, their college education paid for because of the skills that they've acquired with these travel teams. And the fact is that there's just not that many scholarships to go around. It doesn't exist. You know, a fully funded Division I baseball program, I think, has 11.7 scholarships. You know, so I mean, you can talk about whatever, Florida State, Vanderbilt. You know, pick your top 25 team, Stanford. They can't even fully pay for 12 students on their team, and of course, they have more than 12 players on their team. So even at the top universities, the top programs, they're not going to be able to just throw out scholarships willy nilly. So the likelihood of your son, you know, or daughter, I mean, we're talking about baseball, but this obviously applies to other sports too, that they're going to cash in on a scholarship is relatively low. I don't know how many kids that are scholarship caliber players wouldn't get a scholarship if they were not on the travel team. If the travel ball did not exist in the way that it exists now, I think the elite players would still be found. I think they'd still be offered scholarships. They'd still get that exposure, maybe not to the extent that they currently do, but they would be found. And we would just go about it a different way. I'm not going to lie, it is convenient for a coach. It is convenient for me to go down and spend one day at a baseball field and see 150 players do a showcase, do a tournament, you know, they all parade themselves in front of me, and now I just am marking off names. But even with that, I'm like a middle of the road Division III coach. The majority of the kids that I see at these tournaments and showcases could not play for me. Absolutely could not play at this level. And yet they're plunking down thousands of dollars and spending countless hours. So I think I think if the goal is to play Division I baseball or earn a scholarship or play professionally, it falls short of that pretty regularly. If it's just because they enjoy baseball and they want to play as high as they can and it's just the experience, that's a different story. But I don't think that's what it is most of the time.
Well, the biggest thing that I try to tell parents is every college offers academic scholarship money. Mm. Most colleges don't offer baseball money. So
right.
You're really limiting your odds if you're trying to pick a sport and trying to earn Division I scholarship money, whereas every school offers academic assistance. If you spent 1 hour hitting the books rather than your entire weekend at a baseball field, you're going to be much better off in terms of achieving that scholarship that you're seeking.
And not to mention that has longer term benefits, right? than just learning to, and that's not to say you shouldn't practice your craft in baseball or anything like that, but certainly being a better student will pay off in the long, long run beyond college, versus, just that skill in the sport. The other thing, which is ironic with the travel teams, is it has really, I think, made, kind of shrunk the pool of true athletes. Because what it's done is it's forced specialization. If you want to play college baseball, well, you can't play football, you can't play basketball, you can't be spending time doing track and field or any of these other sports. You got to play in our fall tournament team. Then you got to play in our indoor winter league. Then you got to play in our summer tournament team. And so it just becomes this year round grind for baseball. And I think it turns a lot of players off. Even if they are good at it, they can get a little worn down with it. But you don't have that well-rounded athlete. And I think, when I recruit, and there aren't too many guys who play multiple sports in high school these days, certainly far fewer than there were just a decade or two ago. I genuinely think the guys that have played multiple sports have an advantage over guys that have just played baseball. With their athletic ability, but also with just understanding how team dynamics work and personalities work and interacting with coaches work. I think there's a number of different ways that it could work. And if you've only experienced baseball and your skill set is limited to baseball, I think that it actually proves to be a disadvantage. Again, personal opinion and others may disagree, but.
And then we wonder why kids are blowing out their arms at 15 while they're playing all year round and they're throwing the equivalent amount of what a 25-year-old probably threw.
Of course, the mileage on their arms is tremendous. And I think there's other little, baseball is a very odd game in that it's played sideways. You swing sideways, you take lead sideways, you throw the ball sideways. And I think it's very slanted towards your handedness, right? A right-handed player is going to have a much different experience than a left-handed player, and his body is going to be out of balance as a result, And I think people who play multiple sports, if you play soccer or football or basketball, those sports are not quite as, right or left-handed driven. So you kind of can be a more balanced athlete. And I think that's a little healthier, first of all, but I also think that it ends up, translating to being a better baseball player when you get onto the field because you can do things a little, you're just more coordinated.
That's really interesting. I'd never thought of it that way, but you're 100% right. That's really a great point. Well, Coach, I could ask you, I got a bunch of other questions, but I think it may be time to move towards rapid fire and ask you a couple of questions and first thing that comes on or comes to the top of your head?
Sure.
All right. First question. How did you become a baseball fan and what is your first baseball memory?
All right. So I grew up in the Bay Area in, Northern California. I was born in 1980. So I was just starting to take notice of sports and really become, watching sports right around the time the Bash Brothers were becoming the Bash Brothers. So I was very lucky in that I often think I wonder if they weren't good at that time, would I even have cared about baseball? But all my friends wanted to talk about was baseball. They were clearly a good team. They were exciting. And then my uncle took me to Game 5 of the 1988 World Series. And I think that kind of sealed the deal for me, even though it was a heartbreaking loss to the Dodgers. So the next year when they were in the World Series, my mom thought she'd make good, and she brought me to game one of that series. So that was a much happier experience. And then the next year when they went to the World Series, my dad wanted in on the action, so he took me to game three. So, I mean, yes, they lost two of the three. We don't have to talk about Kirk Gibson or, you know, Jose Rijo or anything like that, but or the earthquake that, that sullied the one win that we had. And I said we as though I did something. But I will say 3 years in a row of having a bunch of sports idols in the World Series and have exciting games. And I remember, you know, my school teacher wheeling a TV in during during our school day so we could watch the World Series or the ALCS. I mean, it was just amazing. So that really is what sold me, is those experiences, going to the stadium, getting to watch the World Series. That hooked me.
That's great. That's really good. Next one, best player you've ever coached or watched against while in college.
Oh, best player.
And if you want to include scouted, we can throw that in there, or recruited as well.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Best player I've ever coached. Oh, that's a tough one. I think. I don't know what the absolute. I mean, I have a couple guys that were phenomenal for me. I'll drop their names: Joe Forcellini and Ryan Caperoni, both of whom were teammates in the same class, and both of them in different years won the conference player of the year here, and both were getting looked at to be drafted. Phenomenal players. I think maybe the more interesting story would be when I was at Merchant Marine. There was a young man who, when I first got there, he was also the fullback for the football team, and I had just been hired after fall ball, so basically after the football season, and he had just torn his ACL in football. So he was the baseball stud, but he was out, and he was going to be out for the season. So I never got to actually coach him that year. And then the next year, the way the Merchant Marine works is guys have to go out to sea for part of their sophomore year and a bulk of their junior year. So he actually had to go out to sea for the baseball season. So I didn't get to coach him in the 2 years that I was there. We had this almost, major league level talent, and I never got to see him. But one day while he had his torn ACL and his knee was in a brace, he like hobbled over to practice one day, and our guys, I mean, we weren't very good. We had, you know, the bat swung the hitters. They were all pretty skinny. But, he kind of gets in there. He's a very soft-spoken guy. Davey May was his name. And he gets in, and he's like, Coach, can I just take one round in the cage? I'm like, he got a torn ACL. You're not even on the team right now. I can't do this. I mean, come on. I just need to get a swing. Okay. He goes in. He's got a wood bat. All the other guys are using metal because we use metal. He's got a wood bat. He's got one leg that he's basically leaning on. He took one swing, and I would have thought the ball exploded, you know. And I'm just like, I can't believe this guy. He's the natural. This guy's Roy Hobbs. And he, he kind of like, you know, he just kind of shakes his head at me, you know, thanks, and walks away. Never got to see him. The year I left Merchant Marine, he did come back and play. So he basically took 2 years off, one to rehab a torn ACL, the other to be out at sea. He played his senior year. He was an all American and got a tryout with I think the Cincinnati Reds. So he was a pretty phenomenal player.
Wow, that's amazing.
I missed out on him though. Yep,
that's a great story. Next one, favorite player all time and favorite team all time.
Well, I'd have to say the 89 A's, I suppose, because that's the one team that actually cashed in on the opportunity. The player as a kid, my favorite pitcher for the A's at the time was Bob Welch, and kind of looking back, I don't know that I admit it to myself at the time, but I think Ricky Henderson was my favorite player during that stretch. I had the like fluorescent green Mizuno batting gloves.
Oh, nice!
And I wore those, you know, when I was playing, you know. Despite the fact that my team's uniform was bright red, it clashed, but it was worth it because you looked like Ricky. And, he was something special.
Oh, wow. The John Olerud story is just the greatest story in baseball history. It's awesome.
I'm sorry.
The John Olerud story? You don't know that one?
Oh, when he said, hey, there, I had a teammate that had a helmet like that. Yes.
Yeah, that was great. Me. Yeah, that was me, Ricky. The greatest of all time.
Yeah, that's right. I was trying to remember. Yes, that is a classic. He's entertaining for well beyond just how he played.
Next one. If you were named commissioner of or czar of baseball, doesn't need to be Major League Baseball, but overall baseball, what change or changes would you make if you had one day to make changes?
Oh, man. That one I don't have an answer at the tip of my tongue for. I think what I would probably try and do is, one, I would try and fix the whole minor league system in terms of paying players. I think that needs to be done. Bringing them up to a minimum wage, some sort of livable wage for those guys that are playing at least affiliated ball. But the other thing maybe is to kind of get a true worldwide, international draft going. So that you didn't have all these different systems depending on what country guys are coming from and kind of ways to skirt around the finances and things like that. I'm not so keen on, I would certainly need to outsource this work. but I don't know all the various rules. I don't know all the posting fees and things like that, or how it works with the salary caps and the bonuses. But I just know that it seems to really leave a lot of teams where there's a lot of talent out there that is not accessible to a lot of the teams because they just can't afford to pay for those high profile international free agents. So it's funny. I feel like my two answers are kind of opposing each other a little bit because the draft is, I think, inherently anti-labor and the living wage for minor leaguers is very pro labor, but I think coming up with a fairer solution that doesn't that kind of makes everybody happy, I think is a major challenge, and that's something that I would of course solve in my one day as commissioner.
Great answers, both I agree 100%. So yeah. Final question for you, I need a World Series prediction both for 2016 and 2017.
Okay.
Now, we're recording this. We're 1-1 in the series for full disclosure.
Yes, 1-1 in the series. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, don't post this interview after the series is over so I look like a dope. I think the Cubs are going to win this series. I think I hope we go 7 games just because the whole postseason has been phenomenal. And I really do enjoy both of these teams. Watching the postseason, I mean, Francisco Lindor has become one of my new favorite players. He's just awesome. But I like many others, I've been on the Cubs bandwagon for a couple of years now just because I think they're doing great things there, and I hope that they get it. I mean, for goodness sake, 108 years is long enough. So that I'm saying Cubs in 7 for next year. I'll be honest with you, I think they're pretty set up for a back-to-back run. I mean, there's not a whole lot to dislike there. So much of the talent is young and is back for another year. I think I'd be hard pressed to pick anybody but them right now.
And you're going to be awfully popular in Wrigleyville, I'm telling you.
And I've never been to Wrigley. I need to go. Oh, maybe somebody can throw me one of those $996,000 tickets to the World Series.
Wow, but you got to go. Yeah. I went to Wrigley for the first time this year. It was truly spectacular.
Oh, I was at a coaches convention in Chicago about 3 years ago, and I'd never been to Chicago, and I had no idea where we were, and we didn't really have time to sightsee, and only after we got home did we look on the map, and it turned out we were like maybe a half mile from Wrigley, and never even saw it. So I'm kicking myself for that one.
Yeah, that's when you realize that stadium is legitimately in the middle of a neighborhood. I mean, you really just walk right up to it and you realize, oh, there are a bunch of bars and here's a stadium. Oh, here we go.
Sounds fantastic.
Well, Coach, I want to thank you so much for all your time today. I know I've kept you a little longer than I meant to, but I'd love to give you a spot here for your plugs where everybody can find you online, where they can find the team, and anything you want to plug.
Sure. So if you want to track our team, our athletics website is centenarycyclones.com. So CentenaryCyclones.com. And that's, you know, that'll have all the athletics at the university on there. But you can specifically go to our baseball page and you can see our stats from seasons past, box scores, you know, player profiles, all that kind of stuff is on there in our upcoming schedule. We'll also have a team store that just opened up, and it should be posting to that site soon. So if you want to get some Centenary baseball gear and support the team a little bit for our upcoming spring trip, by all means, feel free to get yourself a nice hoodie or something like that, and you'll be looking good and supporting us, so that'd be great. You can follow us on Twitter. I have the Twitter handle is @CCBaseball. The CC used to be Centenary College, but since we turned to Centenary University, it'll just have to be the CC's now Centenary Cyclones Baseball. And that's about it for how we want to follow. And, you know, our games will be started. I think our first game this year is a doubleheader on March 3rd. So you have a few months to get your baseball gear and show up to Hackettstown, New Jersey, and watch some frigid baseball.
Well, Coach, thank you so much for joining me. It's always a pleasure. I love the insights that I get from a coach, and with how candid and honest you are with your answers. I can't thank you enough for clearing some time, and I hope to run into you sometime this spring and hope to interview you again down the road.
Anytime.
Well, thanks so much. And that was my interview with Centenary Cyclone University head baseball coach Scott Kushner. I want to thank him for joining me. I really do get a lot of enjoyment, and it's just a great time getting to listen to a college baseball coach and their insights into recruiting, Division III baseball, and really everything in between. So I want to thank him for joining me, and I've got to have him back on to goodness, there's so many other topics I wanted to get to. So thanks again, Coach, and good luck this season if we don't talk before then. So with that, two reminders, if I might. If you might, please consider rating, reviewing, and subscribing to the Nats GM show on iTunes, as that helps us gain a larger audience and helps people find us when they're just scrolling through looking for a baseball podcast online. So appreciate that very much. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, the Nats GM show is looking for a sponsor or sponsors for the show. So if you are interested in sponsoring the podcast, please go to natsgm.com for further details. With that, this episode is a wrap. Bye for now.